We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal. Boys and girls, my name is Ty Hildenbrandt, that guy. As always, the monster of the Midwest.
What about Monster of the Midway?
Monster of the Midway?
Yeah.
Did I screw it up?
No, I think it's Monster of the Midway is the Bears, right? Monsters of the Midway?
The Monster of the Midway, Dan Rubenstein, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Had the fun weekend of taking care of children who were sick, as I was also sick, which is not amazing.
You're still sick?
No. It was just like a 24-hour. See, this was like a 24-hour virus. This is what happens when you live amongst children who are amongst children, that you're just going to get stuff. But it was a quickly passing thing, and it was just sort of a Sunday thing. And I recorded an episode of Extra Nuggets with our friend Adam Amin, which stay tuned. But that sapped the life out of me, recording a 35-minute podcast or something. But I'm here now. I had a good night's sleep. I am extremely excited for this show because obviously we love Bill Connolly and we love when he specifically deep dives things and speaks to people that have to do with his expertise, which is all things numbers and trends within college football. So I feel as if there is life coursing through my veins for the first time in a few days, Ty. So I am here for whatever.
Absolutely. I am as well. Thank you to one and all for downloading, for listening. We hope you're subscribing as well. If you haven't already, please do hit the subscribe or follow button on your app of choice. This episode, all our episodes brought to you, driven by our good friends over at Geico. If you want access to this show, to all of our shows a little bit early, if you want bonus video coverage of all of these episodes, you can go on out to verballers.com. That is our Patreon. It's where you can find those bonus features. You also get access to the aforementioned Extra Nuggets that Dan referenced a little bit earlier. You can also get access to our Patreon Discord server, which is always popping off. We had some of the fast food stuff going on, which I think we referenced on one of our shows. Just a lot of off-topic stuff and a good group of people and fans of the Solid Verbal, to say the absolute very least.
The best.
Of course, follow along on social media if you haven't already, and go on out to solidgiveaway.com if you want to get your name in the hat to win that signed A.J. Brown Ole Miss mini helmet. Got about another week and a half or so.
How about after we talk to Bill, we will, because tonight, as we're recording this on Monday, tonight is the College Basketball National Championship. You and I go through the Final Four of the fast food bracket that has become a sensation on the Solid Verbal Patreon. How about that?
I'm fine with this. And I should also add one final editorial point, We recorded this with Bill on Friday.
Correct.
A little bit out of order here. Typically, we everything in one fell swoop, but we were able to get Bill's time on Friday. We recorded on Friday, and what happened on Friday was a World Cup draw.
Yep.
So Bill, of course, being very interested in that world, yours truly being very interested in that world, a little bit of World Cup draw talk as a postscript, let's say.
Yeah, why not?
To our college football discussion, where we talk about the state of analytics and much, much more.
I would argue that there is a similar DNA to the insanity that surrounds, and I will say club soccer is maybe one of the most, maybe one of the only sports that features a more insane culture than college football does. And I know, you know, things around, there's different sports around the world, and the rabid nature of cricket fandom and the rabid nature of, you know, rugby or union or Australian rules. I understand all of that. But college football is different, folks. And you all know this. This is why you're listening to
it's a different animal.
A podcast in April about going for it on fourth down. But there is a lot of overlap. And I am stressing to you that, and I'm going to just say it right now. I'm going to establish this as fact. Ty is going to do a World Cup stream centered around the United States men's national team in the lead up to because it's an insane November, right? Because the World Cup is starting and college football is at its absolute apex.
Yeah.
I'm going to force Ty to do a YouTube live stream with the soccer / international football talker of his choice.
Yeah. We'll find
Maybe
somebody.
Can we get Rebecca Liu?
I don't know. We'll see who we can get, but I'm down. Okay. And I can hold my own. You know, I can hold my own.
Yeah, no, you're into it. So I'm forcing Ty to do that on our college football, youtube.com/thesolidverbal.
Pushing me out of the solid verbal nest. I appreciate that.
Of course.
Alrighty, Dan joining us now. Longtime friend of the verbal, joining us on a momentous day, which we'll get to in just a little bit here. Bill Connolly from ESPN. Sir, welcome back. How are you?
It's been so long. It's been like, you know, 3 months since we talked. I was missing it.
What's
going
on?
So I wrote something specifically to get me going back on here.
Yeah. It's good. You did a great job. You did a fantastic job. Bill C. secretly on the road all of the time. I don't know if you went on the road at all for this piece specifically, or you just made phone calls.
This one was a phoner, but making up for lost time in the travel department.
Love to hear it. Okay, Ty, the name of the piece is The State of Analytics in Football, largely college football, but some NFL. Yes, yeah. Ty, did you read it? Did you love it? Is it now a part of your lifestyle?
State of Analytics in College Football, fourth downs, yes. Two-point conversions, Lane Kiffin, mm-hmm. and what's next? So, look, Bill, we've come to you for all topics analytics now for a good long time, and I think you do a really good job of putting pieces like this together to just sort of inform the rest of us who aren't as in the weeds with where we stand on things. I can say I can't ever recall a season in which Dan and I talked more about fourth down conversions, notably with guys like Dave Aranda, who seemingly changed his approach in the offseason. Certainly Lane Kiffin. We've seen it a lot more at the NFL level. You put this, you know, all into words here in your article for ESPN.com, but let's talk a little bit about fourth downs. How much meat is still on the bone, so to speak, when it comes to fourth downs? Are coaches going for it enough from an analytical perspective? Where is the efficiency to be had moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I remember, you know, I started going to the Sloan Conference, this Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in 2012. And I remember by like 2014, I was so tired of fourth downs because that was the only thing with football. It was always obvious that was going to be kind of the first thing that got crossed off the list. It was the easiest from a math standpoint. You could pretty clearly define like here's when they should be going for it or shouldn't. But nothing was really happening. Nothing was really changing. And so I felt like it was a conversation killer. It was a sign that there is no progress being made in football. So let's talk about another sport. And so I was so sick of talking about fourth downs. But then over the last 4 years, coaches have actually started to listen to the nerds a little bit, and they've made up a ton of ground. I had this in the piece, but yeah, like in 2017 in college football, teams went for it 60% of the time on fourth and one. overall. And of course, that means it was like, you know, whatever the split was, like 80% in on you know, in opponent's territory and like 30% in your own or whatever the those numbers were. It's up to 74% now. 14, it jumped 7% in 18, and then it just kept right on rising in these recent years. At the pro level, they were only going for it 44% of the time in 2017, and that's up to 70%. They've almost caught college. So in that way, I mean, it's definitely not necessarily optimized, but it's getting a lot closer. Teams are going for it over 90% of the time in opponent's territory in college, mm-hmm. which is nuts, considering where things were. There is still plenty of meat on the bone, so to speak. Number one, teams still won't really go for it all that much on the other side. There's like Mike McRoberts from Championship Analytics, who I talked to for the piece. He said there's like some mythical barrier at the 50-yard line. If it's like the opponent's 45, they're like, all right, we can do this. If it's your 45, they're like, ah, I don't know, better play it safe. We better punt this. But there's still plenty of recommendations that they're not listening to in terms of going forward on fourth down in your own territory. And while the percentages are rising, there are still a lot of situations where the numbers very much say, you know, fourth and three, four, five, six, you should be going for it. And that's getting better, but it's still not very far along. So, but the lowest hanging fruit is fourth and one and fourth and two. And we're actually seeing those numbers match up a lot closer to how they should be than what we're used to seeing.
What's the barrier? What is the barrier? It's hard to paint an entire industry of more old-fashioned coach think and paint that brush widely, because every coach, every situation, every background is different.
Yep.
But in the guys you've talked to, and notably you talked to Lane Kiffin, who, if there were ever somebody who would be more inclined to be a younger person who thinks like an older person,
yeah,
given his background, given his father, given like the coaches he's coached under,
yep,
what is the thing that stands in the way of coaches giving themselves and their teams advantages?
You're still basically you're potentially signing up to lose quicker. And
yep,
Lane Kiffin said this when I was talking to him. I've used this analogy too. It's like hitting on 16 in blackjack. You know, there are certain specific cases where you're supposed to, like where the odds say it's the best play depending on what the dealer is showing and all that other stuff. But when it's time to actually say hit me, when you've got 16, you're like, no, I'll just go ahead and I'm done, and you lose. And so that's a huge part of it. When there's actual money on the line, if you go for it and fail versus if you punt, and you know, if you lose either way, you'll still catch much more crap if you went for it and failed than if you punted. It just feels like the safer choice because it's going to get you yelled at less. And I think that is, again, I think that is starting to turn, at least on fourth and one specifically. But that is always going to be the biggest part of it. Even if you know what the odds say, you also know how people will react. And it just feels like, even if you go ahead and lose, by punting, you're stalling. You're holding off finding out if you're going to win or lose or not a little bit longer. And that still makes it feel like a safer play, even if the numbers say it's not.
Is that a way? Sorry to jump in. Is that a media thing too, though? Is that like an older fashioned football thinker
who's
typing, like an older columnist who's saying they lost because they did this?
Right.
And then they have the attention of fans, right?
Right.
It's not just a coach thing. It's an ear thing. It's an eye thing of who has the attention.
Yeah. And that was, the whole thing with the Chargers and Staley last year when they went for it and failed three times against the Chiefs, like they'd gone for it and gotten it a lot in other games, and it helped them win other games, and that just became part of the win. But when they lost to the Chiefs doing it, it became why they lost.
Right.
And so there is that. And you still hear it, even not even necessarily with like the older announcers, you still hear any announcer basically like they're guaranteed to say like, oh, they're going to roll the dice here. They're going to go for it.
I don't know about this.
And
yeah.
When it turns from an odds perspective, punting is the risk. Punting would be risking it, not going for it.
Bill, this may be kind of an ignorant question, but, whenever we talk about fourth downs, there's the chart, right? And you certain percentage of getting the play, getting the first down, depending on what the distance is to go. What I haven't seen, and I'm sure you have, is there like kind of the inverse of that, such that like, okay, you don't get it, if you don't get it now, these are the expected points that are on the line based on field position, based on essentially like what is your risk tolerance. Does anything inform coaches on that level?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I don't think they're the only ones, but I know Championship Analytics does pretty much exactly that. And that's what, you know, the analytics department that NFL teams have now, that's kind of their main, it's an expected points kind of a win probability sort of thing. And so... Like, for instance, if we just stick with the 4th-and-1 example, if you're on the opponent's one, then it's a very vociferous, you should absolutely go for this, because if you fail, they're going to get the ball at the one. And you're still the next, well, I mean, fumbles and whatnot aside, but they're still, even if you fail, you're still the more likely team to score next from that situation. The further back you go, obviously that changes because the field position changes. And so that is absolutely part of the even championship is going to take, where are you on the field? How good's your punter? Is this a defensive battle or is it supposed to be a high scoring affair? They're going to take all those things into account when they spit out the recommendation for certain situations for exactly that reason. It is the likely resulting field position of your opponent plays a big role there.
Is this also a communication thing between not just the coach and his assistants, but also the coach and his bosses? I think we may have even talked about it with you, the old, like, I think it was Paul D. Podesta quote about the Browns are doing this, right? This is who we are as the Browns. We're tanking, we're building up draft picks, and everybody's good with the roller coaster until it gets into weird places. Is this a matter of... We'll use the Lane Kiffin example. Lane Kiffin telling his boss or boosters, his assistants, this is who we are as a program. Yep. We are not making a decision case by case in that, like, sometimes we'll trust analytics, sometimes we won't. Is there a matter of identity involved with this? This is who we are, and we're going to ride the math for better or for worse, because that gives us the best opportunity. And do some coaches, and Brandon Staley did this, obviously. He succeeded a ton, and sometimes it let him down. That's the math of it. Is there an issue with coaches being sort of half pregnant with this?
it certainly helps to make sure your boss knows... probably when they're doing the hiring in the first place, like, I want to be aggressive in these situations. Or again, you know, that might not be the right word. I want to follow the math in these situations. Right. And as Kiffin pointed out, I think I put it in the piece, you also have to tell your defense what's going on. Not only your bosses, but they need to know that you're going for it because you're just going to go for it. You're an aggressive, you want to stay on the front foot and all that other stuff. You're not going for it because you don't think your defense can make stops. That becomes an issue too if they think, you know, he doesn't trust us. That's why they're taking these risks right now and blah, blah, blah. You got to understand from the start, like, this is who we're going to be. That absolutely, I think, helps to build some bridges in those situations. I mean, the math is still the math, but yeah, letting people know in advance, like, this is what we intend to do, not catching people off guard by doing it, that can't hurt.
Is there an age, this is an insane question, is there an age where you suddenly would not trust a coach to change, to evolve, right? Because you spoke to a younger coach. I don't know Lane Kiffin's age right now, but he is certainly still, even though he's been in the game for a long time, younger. Dave Aranda is younger. Brandon Staley is younger. Jimbo Fisher is not younger. Right. Nick Saban might be one of those exceptions that he has been on the forefront of evolving the way he runs his program and the way he recruits and the way his systems, especially on offense, evolve. Is there an age where you're just like, it's too late for Kirk Ferentz to change? It's too late for David Shaw to change.
Oh, David Shaw. He needs to.
Right.
Anyway.
Ultimate eye roll name. Yeah.
I would say it's more of a curve, you know. Okay. Like, it's more of a the older are the less likely. But Kyle Whittingham, I mean, mentioned that he's 62 and he's been one. Now, when he signed up for championship, he was still in his 50s. But that's still... I think maybe part of it comes down to also, like, you know, the jobs where you know you have to figure out edges, where you know you're not just going to line up talent versus talent and beat teams. You have to be a little more open-minded. You're still going to find some coaches in those jobs that would never, ever, ever go this route. But the Whittinghams of the world, and I'm trying to remember, Ferentz might be a client of theirs too.
Okay.
Of all the ways that he's conservative, I think his fourth down strategy actually isn't horrible.
Okay.
He needs to learn that throwing the ball well can help a lot of things. There are other issues, but from fourth down perspective, he might actually be okay too.
when you look across the sport, are there especially, and I mentioned some of those names, but are there obvious cases where you're like, this team is just leaving money on the table? This team is just, they have put together such a potentially winning program.
Yeah.
And because of the way they make decisions, that this is a 7-win program that should ultimately be an annual 9-win program.
I mean, A&M is the first one that comes to mind. They're obviously more than a 7-win program, or at least they should be pretty soon. Mm-hmm. What were they, 8-5 this year?
Always 8.
Well, 9-1 the year before.
Yeah, that's true.
But it does feel like, I mean, Jimbo, obviously, like, their lines are great. The talent levels are increasing, obviously. But there are just certain aspects of what you might call modernization that he just doesn't give a crap about. And fourth downs are one of them. He had the, you know, when asked about that before the A&M Ole Miss game last year, where, you know, hey, Lane Kiffin goes for it a lot. What about you? You never go for it. And he's like, well, there's a time and a place, and that's not an analytic, and blah, 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 blah. And there's no book that can tell you to all that stuff. Like that, and his offense, not a lot of bells and whistles. He has beliefs in this regard.
Right.
He is going to ride those beliefs as far as they will go. And it got them a top 5 finish in 2020. They beat Alabama last year. Like, it can take them very far, but it still feels like they're leaving points on the table and making their, like the Rams. Like, Rams won the Super Bowl. He's allergic to fourth downs, but you can still win. You're just leaving. You're making your job harder. And I don't like the thought of making my job harder. I like to make it easier when possible.
The first / second cousin of fourth down conversions is probably 2-point conversions. You referenced this in the piece as well. Do I understand this correctly, that the conversion percentage in college football was 44.7, almost 45% on 2-point tries?
It popped up this year. And we'll see if that's an outlier or whatever, but yeah. And the odds are going to be lower in college because it's from the 3 as opposed to the 2. Mm-hmm. Which does mess with the math a little bit, but they were strangely high this year.
Not only is it higher by about 5% over the last 6 years, but also a great number more 2-point conversions. So is analytics driving that decision on the coaching front? Is it style of play? What do you attribute, I guess, the rise in just straight up conversion attempts?
Well, I should look at the quality of offense and the role that played. Like, maybe they're the ones going for it more right now, or going for 2 more frequently right now, and they have the better offenses. Therefore, the percentages are going to be higher. But I think there are a couple of scenarios now where you're seeing teams, the whole down 14 score and go for 2 thing. Or down 15 and go ahead and go for 2 after the first touchdown, so you know whether, you know, you're still down 1 score or 2 after that.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing certain scenarios where just enough coaches have done it. It's been just enough of a conversation topic that we're starting to see that more frequently. I'm not the whole 44.7% thing. Like, I'm still, that popped up quite a bit, and so that might not be real. We'll have to see if it's the kind of the new level now moving forward. Maybe people started seeing successful plays and putting them in the playbook or something. But the most interesting thing there is that, you know, the percentage of touchdowns where a team went for 2 did go up a little bit, like 1.5%, something over these last few years. And that's probably due to those specific scenarios. It does seem like that's something we're talking about a little bit more and seeing a little bit more. And I love it. I mean, the whole down 14 thing is awesome because you could basically get 2 shots at, as long as you go 1 for 2, then you're still, tying the game if you score 2 touchdowns. And if you get the first one, suddenly you're down 6 and you can win it with an extra point. I love that one. But I like to see the teams are using that one a little more often.
Bill, if you were out there coaching a team and if you had these numbers in front of you, given all the pressures that, you know, big time head coaches are under right now, with especially the media and all the money that's involved, how would you play it? Like, would you go straight by the book like you were playing a blackjack hand and just play the probability? do you think you'd, I mean, Lane Kiffin referenced it in your article about how it's one thing to say it on a sheet and see the numbers. Right. It's another to have it occur in front of 100,000 people with, and knowing that you're going to have to answer for it after the fact. Do you feel like coaches are still a little too gun shy when it comes to this and they need to somehow find a way to toughen up?
They are absolutely too gun shy. And also I probably would be too.
Yeah.
The blackjack example is perfect because I would play blackjack on my phone. I know all the 16 and they're showing this boom hit. And then you like a $10 hand at the casino or whatever, you're like, I'll stay. And I mean, I've done it. I'd like to think, well, let's put it this way. If I'm hired as a head coach, it's probably because of analytics and therefore I should probably be following them at all times. I absolutely understand the clamming up in those situations because it's just so easy to do.
What are the variables involved, both in fourth down conversions and in 2-point conversions? Obviously, you're going to listen to coaches who are always going to say, we are weighing a number of factors, not just the numbers of like it's fourth and one from this yard line, but it's obviously the score. It's the health. Like, are you starting a backup offensive line? Obviously, that changes, you know, the dynamic of what you're able to do on offense. Is there also a threshold of how bad your defense is in order to be going for more fourth downs? Because that's the only way you can win games. Well, so what are the variables at play?
That second part is actually, I think, more important than people realize. I mean, the first part is like, if you're playing Alabama and you're a 28-point underdog or whatever, you might want to take some chances here. That's probably the only way you're going to make up that deficit. It's probably not going to matter what you do, but you should probably figure out some risks to take or at least open yourself up to a little more risk tolerance. But I do think one thing that people don't necessarily think as much about is not only like how bad is your defense, but also like how bad is theirs? Is this supposed to be a 38-38 game or a 16-16 game? Because if it's the latter, you know, punting and knowing that you're probably about to force another punt too, like suddenly that field position game starts to matter a little more. If it's supposed to be a high scoring track meet, where it, like voluntarily giving the ball to the other team instead of trying to get a yard yourself suddenly looks like the craziest move in the world. So that part, I think the game flow or the expected game flow is absolutely an area that matters maybe a lot more than we think.
This is also going to sound silly, and I hope it does sound silly because that's sort of the intention. If you are employed as a doctor, if you are employed as a lawyer, if you're employed as a banker, there is an element of continued education that you have to stay current with the latest updates to your field. How do you get through to coaches? How do you, beyond shaming them online and in print or on TV?
Which doesn't seem to work nearly as well as we want it to.
Right. How do you talk to an offensive coordinator? How do you get through to a head coach when there is already going to be an intact belief system, right or wrong? How do you approach continued education when it comes to decision making? That's the big question, right?
That's a very good question. I mean, it really is kind of like what we've seen here in that you find the crazy guys who are willing to listen. It's Munkin at Army, whether it's Kiffin at Ole Miss and some others, obviously. You find those and they beat the team. They start beating the teams on with very specific fourth down conversions. They start beating the teams with the conservative old coaches who don't necessarily feel like they need to change.
Right.
And just the overall, I mean, I do think there's something to be said about just the overall behavior shift over enough of a period of time. We've seen that a little bit with running and passing over the last 25 years. Obviously, the run rates haven't changed very much in this century, but they've still changed from 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
And so, I do think there's something to be said for just at some point enough guys are doing it that it becomes kind of the conventional wisdom, the this is what we do kind of deal. And you know, and then the older coaches who are too conservative to do anything about that retire and, you know, it becomes a more widespread deal.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
How much do you know and have you jumped into the internal team data? Because we have, every single program has analysts and interns and video departments that have these crazy databases of, this is what Iowa State does against 12 personnel in nickel or whatever.
Right.
And so they have granular data with which to work. And yet, and this is every program, and yet teams are struggling to adjust, are struggling to take risks, are struggling to evolve. Are there teams that do a particularly good job internally of using data to grow?
Alabama.
Yeah. Right.
Like that, I mean, this is kind of like in European soccer where like the teams that are best with data are like Liverpool and Manchester City and
right.
teams that had all the money anyway. But I mean, I do think we know a lot of the ones that evolve and grow really well because they continue to remain at the top of the sport. And, you know, others that fall off that a little bit, that might be one of the reasons why. But I'm looking at, let's see, if we just look at straight fourth down attempts, well, this is going to be kind of tricky because Alabama didn't really face many fourth downs to begin with.
Right.
So that it, like that's not going to work very well. But, you know, LSU was up pretty high. Baylor was up pretty high. You know, Tennessee was up pretty high. Those are pretty young coaches, Tennessee and Baylor.
Has the data gotten better, by the way? Has that data gotten better with better tracking? I assume so. Everything gets better. But like, have there internally been has there been movement forward in terms of how accurate that data tracking is?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, actually, this is kind of beside the point a little bit, but I do think one thing that's going to help a lot when it comes to proper decision making and just proper like understanding of the situation, once we get to the point of having video tracking and whatnot, which we're not there yet for college, there will be, we'll be able to very clearly understand the difference between what does fourth and one mean? Is that fourth in 6 inches? Because that's like going to be like 90% success rate.
Right.
But fourth and 1.44 feet or whatever, or yards, is that's going to be more like, you know, 65% or something to that effect. And so that alone, and we will get there pretty soon, I think, that alone will make, a big difference as just in terms of awareness and everything else. That wasn't really the point, but I do think that's an area where
right.
we can still make a pretty good improvement.
Bill, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to ask about that next. So explain to us what you mean by video tracking, because when I think video tracking in football, I think of Sunday Night Football on NBC where they hit a button and we got yellow lines running up and down the field and you can see what everybody's path was.
Yep.
Right.
From the
stuff Barnwell posts all the time because he has that available with his sport.
The dots.
Yeah.
Exactly. So how does video tracking in the manner that you're describing it translate to college football, and what does that mean from a data standpoint?
Well, I don't know if we're going to get dots in college. That comes from, like, you know, the chips in the shoulder pads and all that. And that, when you think about the way colleges run, or really not at all run, that would be like the SEC doing it, but nobody else, or the Big Ten deciding to do it, but nobody else. And so that's not going to really become widespread. But what we're seeing, and I think Seth Walder in the piece had a list of companies that were trying to do this. I can only vouch for one of the ones he mentioned, which is StatsBomb. I've gotten to see some of the stuff StatsBomb is doing. And basically, with StatsBomb, they run soccer at this point with what they do from a data perspective. And it's basically, you know, they've got a farm of video people, you know, where they get the XY set up on the broadcast, and they can tell that that's, you know, there's 0.6 yards to go here, not necessarily just fourth and one. They can get really very, very specific about the distances we're talking about. And if you do that, and you can basically measure exactly where the players are on the screen at all times, which obviously helps to have the all 22, but you know, you can still learn a lot more about routes and all that, like very specific information about routes, about how far a quarterback can throw the ball, like literal yardage, not necessarily 12 yards downfield, but that specific pass traveled 17.916 yards or whatever. Once you get to that stage, it's not the same as chips and shoulder pads, but it serves 85% of the same purpose. And so you can get to where you're measuring speed a lot better, and passing a lot better, and line splits, and all this other kind of stuff. And that's going to be really cool. I think that's going to help coaches a lot. And you know, like Brian Burke said in my piece, like all the stuff he has for pros regarding, like, you know, the pass block win rates and all that stuff, once we have this kind of level of data, like everything is already set up. He can just kind of plug in what he's already got, and suddenly we have it for 131 teams in college to some degree. And that changes scouting. It changes decision making in games. It changes just a boatload of stuff that could be really, really interesting.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Like how would it change my decision if I were a coach? Just an example.
Well, the decision making part, I mean, like it changes. It changes scouting, opponent scouting.
Sure.
Especially in terms of like line splits and you know. If you're lined up wide, great. Does that mean you're all the way at the sideline on average? Does it mean you're like at the hash? What all that kind of stuff. But then the decision making, what I mean by that is, among other things, being able to tell what's fourth and a half yard and what the odds of conversion and stuff, being a little more specific with that would help a lot.
You know, one of the other things that I know you called out in the piece is the split between running and passing, and how currently in the NFL, passing game's a little bit more efficient. There is still this deep-seated desire to establish the run, quote-unquote establish the run. But, you know, this is another frontier where both in college and pro there is some efficiency perhaps to be gained. Specifically, I believe you referenced first down. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was I was shocked that the Bills, like, in 2020, the Bills, that was like their whole hack was basically we're just going to throw a lot on first down, and you're not going to be able to gang up on Josh Allen at all. Like, you know, the run game is going to be kind of minimized a little bit, but you always have to be wary of what Josh Allen can do. And it's always going to leave 7 yard passes to the sideline open, and we're never going to fall off schedule. They're still like by far doing that more than anybody else in the NFL. I kind of thought other teams would use that as an example. We've seen that forever. Like I remember one year at Nebraska started the year, like Taylor Martinez was throwing a lot on first downs, and it made them kind of unstoppable because like it just set up constant second and fours that they could then run and convert. And so it was like it was interesting looking at a lot of those pass percentages though, because in general, like they jumped a few years ago in the NFL, but then kind of fell back a little bit. And part of that was potentially because of what defenses were presenting to quarterbacks, like on run pass options, making sure they read run, stuff like that. But that growth that seemed to happen, because passing really is still dramatically more efficient than running, I kind of thought we'd see more of that growth. And at the college level, the run pass rates are exactly the same as they were in like 2001 for the most part, which was shocking to see. But so I don't know. Like, it seems like obviously at the college level, it's the run pass thing is always going to be more run friendly because you can actually get more out of the run game in college, especially when you have the advantages to do so. But it is strange. That hasn't risen as much as I expected it to.
The thing you do, and this is what you do, is you quantify, right? You quantify the best teams at defending explosion plays. You quantify the best teams at generating first downs on first and second downs. What we're talking about is coaching decisions.
Yeah.
Is there a metric somewhere, be it with college analytics, be it with somebody who is able to grade coaches objectively on the rightest decision makers in terms of fourth and short, in terms of passing on first down, which is a little bit more objective because there's more variables there. Yeah. But two-point conversions situationally, all those things. Is there a way to quantify the rightest dudes?
I know, who is it? Edge Sports. They are Football Outsiders is now under their umbrella, among other things. I know they will put out during the season, like the coaches who are doing it right the most.
That's better English than I just used. Right. Yes.
But yeah, I mean, they do that. And you think about like a lot of the teams, I don't think I'm there yet. I'm probably not going to be there by September. It does seem like decision making, if you are constantly closer to optimizing your decision making, you're probably going to win more close games than everybody else. You're probably going to, like, Northern Illinois went for it a ton. Like, they seem to be very, very on the ball in that regard. They won a ton of close games. SP Plus didn't like them because it didn't seem necessarily sustainable. But if it's if part of it that is coming from good decision making, like, I always get yelled at because SP Plus hates Army or whatever, it did in those years when they were going 10-3 and 11-2. Well, they were making a whole lot of right decisions where other teams were giving points away in those decision opportunities. So it does seem like if there's a good way to quantify that it should probably be taken into account with something like SP Plus, because you're just more likely to make the right calls at the right time in close games, and it's probably going to give you a semi-permanent edge, so to speak.
Is there a way to situationally grade schools and coaches? The big example I remember from this past year was, I think Penn State got the ball back against Michigan late with essentially a chance to drive and win it and gave it back immediately. They looked lost. They looked like they didn't have a plan. And there's this whole frontier, and we've talked about this before, of like the 4-minute offense.
Right.
And these are just all of my dreams. And there's too many variables for it to be absolute. But I want to know that Jeff Grimes or Joe Moorhead or whoever, like Steve Sarkisian when he was at Alabama, any of these guys, this guy is 14-2 in 4-minute offense. Like, you know what? I want a record of like, okay, we'll take away like drops and turnovers, but everything within this guy's control, we can quantify this coordinator's record. So when it comes to hiring, which is another thing that you would like to have as much data as you can, you're like, yeah, we're going to hire the guy who's 9-0 with his 4-minute offense.
Who kills games when he has a chance to kill games. Yeah. Well, I think one of the things I've talked to coaches about before is like, is it really a 4-minute drill? Is it more like a 3-minute and 25-second? Like, at what point do you enter that mode most effectively? And it was kind of, I mean, I didn't come up with a good answer, I don't think. I do think a lot of coaches go into that too quickly. Like the basketball team that starts milking clock when they're up 6 with 7 minutes left or something.
Right.
You can certainly go into that mode too quickly and it ends up just, you know, meaning you call 3 conservative plays and you punt with 5 minutes left or something.
Right.
So you do have to time it correctly. And that is something that I know coaches have always been kind of curious about. I'm sure some of them still use just under 4 minutes left, let's go 4-minute offense. But that is something very interesting. It's obviously harder than saying they went for it on fourth when they were supposed to. Therefore, you know, that's more quantifiable than this. But it is definitely a very, very interesting thing that I think at least some coaches are open-minded to finding out they're doing wrong.
Fair.
Bill, we've talked a lot about grading other people's stats, grading how coaches are doing. How do you grade your own? How did the SP Plus do in 2021?
Well, the days of SP Plus beating Vegas are over. it just is. Like, informally, Like everything I've heard is you know, there are, it's basically part of the opening line now, in a lot, for some books anyway. And so, yeah, it's over. It's not, SP Plus is always going to lose to injury adjusted and context adjusted SP Plus. It just is. But I mean, obviously the way you can measure your own predictive, like among other things, is like what's the average error in a given game? You can still evaluate that. And I've certainly found a couple of things to tinker with this season that might help that a little bit. It had its best year by far, both in terms of absolute error and against the spread in 2019, I think, which probably is one of the things that, you know, with that and, you know, moving to ESPN and all that kind of got it a little bit more on books radars. But this year was still a little bit weird from an average error standpoint, and whether that's something that's in a measure's control, whether it's just the way things are going to be with more teams kind of packing it in a little earlier in the season. And,
right.
Because that's where it started to fall apart, was late in the year.
I want metric level analysis where you're like, okay, starting with week 6 or starting with week 8, the team who has the better explosive play defense beats Vegas X percent of the time, or the team who stops explosive passes, or the team who generates explosive runs. Like, that's, I want metric level analysis, and I will not stop until you give it to us.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll get back to you on that one.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, is there a specific week where the data becomes especially accurate? Maybe not over the course of a year.
I mean, it's kind of the lines certainly get better over the last half of the year, where like Vegas has a better read on the teams. And of course, then, you know, injuries have taken effect in certain ways. And SP Plus is always going to be a little slow to react to injuries because I don't adjust for injuries. So it's not going to do that very well. But it definitely, the lines have historically gotten a lot better over the second half of the season. And you know, on the flip side of that, SP Plus used to kill Vegas in the first month of the season because of that. The preseason projections seem to be the strongest thing that I bring to the table overall. And you can kind of ride that for a little bit early in the season, and then the lines adjust and it gets a lot harder.
Bill Connolly, ESPN. As always, we appreciate your insight. I can't let you go, though, without asking about the World Cup draw, because we are.
I wasn't going to go without talking about the World
Cup. Yeah, of course.
You weren't going to get rid of me.
I would do no such thing. We are recording this a little early. Typically, we'd record with Bill on a Monday, but made more sense today to do it on a Friday. So we are recording quite literally right after they drew the U.S. in Group B with England, with Iran, and with the winner of the European playoff, which would be either Wales, Scotland, or Ukraine. I'm guessing you watched this. I know you watched this. I know you're into it as much as anybody. What's like your initial take on what you saw, and what our chances are as the United States of America?
Well, I mean, the first thing I saw was I'd rather be in Mexico's group. Mexico got Argentina, Saudi Arabia, and Poland. Obviously, Argentina and England kind of cancel out, but I think Iran is better.
Iran.
Okay. Is better than Saudi Arabia, I think, or at least just tougher, a more physical team. Mm-hmm. And whoever wins that UEFA playoff, I think, is better than Poland. So Mexico definitely got a little bit more favorable draw, but it could be a hell of a lot worse, couldn't it? I mean, even if we assume a loss to England, which is not necessarily a fair assumption by any means, you know, between Iran and I don't know who I would guess is coming out of that. Maybe I don't know. Wales was my first thought, but like, that's not bad. You take more points from them than they take from you, and you're in pretty good position to advance. It could be a lot worse. The biggest thing for the U.S. though is like, let's actually see the first string on the field at some point. You know, let's have a little moratorium on injuries for the rest of 2022. Get Weston McKennie and Gio Reyna on the field at the same time. Sounds pretty awesome. And if the full strength American team that we haven't ever seen before, like 20 minutes over the summer, all the best players played. Seems like it could be pretty good, and they could do something in this group.
I think of it from a couple different perspectives, right? I mean, we've had this conversation before. We're both into it. We're both very plugged into what's going on here. I also think of it from the perspective of a college football fan, and November is going to be nuts. It is going to be nuts for those of us, especially that cover it, but particularly for anybody who cares about it, because this is going to start spinning up just before Thanksgiving. So that will encompass rivalry week, and that will certainly encompass championship week, depending on how deep the United States goes. But certainly the tournament is going to go pretty deep into December. Have you given any thought, Bill, to what that's going to be like? Because you cover both worlds.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm definitely not always super tired and maybe a little crankier than normal by late November because of everything already. So that definitely won't be a problem. No, it is going to be something. I mean, the fact that Missouri, Arkansas, and England, America are happening on the same day, that's the weirdest thing in the history of the world. I much prefer this World Cup happening in June and July and whatnot. This is going to be super weird. But, I mean, I guess this is what the fall of 2020 prepared us for. Like, any event can happen at any time. Kentucky Derby? Here comes the Kentucky Derby. French Open Masters, in late September? Let's roll.
The Masters, good call.
The Masters, that's right. Yeah, so this is we're ready for this moment, I guess, or we're ready as we're ever going to be.
I watch some U.S. men's national team. I'm not a diehard. I don't watch international football, as it were. What is this team? I mean, you mentioned that the best players haven't really played together, but if you are going into the World Cup as an optimistic American soccer international football fan, what is the identity? What is the strength? What is the question? Like, is it just from everything I can tell, it's just like everybody's screaming, play the freshmen. They have higher ceilings. What is it that if you could encompass a description of the appeal of this squad, how would you do it?
Well, I mean, playing the freshmen is definitely part of it. This is the most talented freshman class that has ever come through the United States Football Club. It is. I mean, You've got Gio Reyna, you've got a whole bunch of guys who are playing for very, very high level clubs in Europe. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's funny looking back at like 94 when we were really excited that somebody, you know, would basically be like riding the bench at Bayer Leverkusen. And now you've got a guy in McKinney who starts often for Juventus, and Reyna, who is probably, when healthy at least, the second or third best player on Borussia Dortmund at the moment, and he's freaking 19 or whatever.
Right.
Virginia Dest plays for Barcelona, and even if they aren't necessarily humongous stars at those clubs, they play for those clubs. That's different. That's extremely different. And what was most frustrating about this whole qualification tournament is, you know, we built the whole thing up as, you know, we're going to see Reyna, Pulisic, who's, you know, an old man at 22. You've got McKinney, who's also old at 22. Tyler Adams in defensive midfield is awesome. You've got Dest. Those five never saw the field at the same time the entire tournament. One of them was always hurt, usually Reyna, who, when he came back in this group, looked phenomenal. Okay. As a little reminder about how good he could be. So
who's the superstar of this group then? Like, who, if they hit their ceiling, is the supernova?
The headliner is still Pulisic.
Right.
The headliner is still Pulisic. Okay. But I think the underrated part of the team is the midfield. And certainly we saw that a little bit, Bill, and you can test this more than me. But with Wes McKinney being hurt this past qualifying window, there were a lot of anxious moments. I mean, what he does in the midfield, the fact that he's as physical as he is, that he's so calm on the ball, that he makes the right passes, he always seems to be in the right place. You combine him with a guy like a Tyler Adams, more recently with a guy like a Yunus Musah, who gets forward a little bit more. There's a nice balance in the midfield that I don't remember us having at any point in, you know, somewhat recent memory.
Yeah, Musah is a guy who, like, he plays for Valencia in Spain. He doesn't play a ton for Valencia. Valencia's not that great in Spain. So he hasn't really found his footing in club yet, but when he's right, but he's a very good ball handler, basically, to put it in those terms. He basically complements McKinney and Adams perfectly, especially when Dest is also healthy, because he's super fast on going down the right flank. And so you can just really frazzle opponents when you've got really physical McKinney, really controlled Adams, very, very good dribbler and whatnot in Musah, and in just super fast Dest. You can distract opponents with those guys, and you still have Pulisic and Reyna ready to do a lot of damage in the box. And so they all, I think that's been the most exciting part, is realizing how complementary they all seem to be. And the most frustrating part is that we haven't ever seen them on the field at the same time to prove this.
The other thing I'll point out real quick, Dan, and then we'll let Bill
go.
Do it.
I have one more question. But go for it.
The other thing I'll point out is if it's a 23-man roster, what percentage would you say, Bill, is always willing to get into a fight at a moment's notice? I'd say it's at least 70%.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, we all, like, Pulisic, you know, almost started a fight against Panama, and he didn't even have Big McKinney there backing him up. That was
I like that.
That was exciting.
They're
was
always
exciting.
Ready for a throwdown. They're always ready for a throwdown.
Exciting as, like, when he scored the goals. Like, that was great. But it is funny because the most noteworthy thing that happened in qualification is because they didn't have all the right pieces. You know, Greg Berhalter, they want to control the ball. They want to be able to play the more ball control, a heavier possession style really well. But because they didn't have all the right pieces there, it became this weird situation in qualification where they wanted to control the ball. And the more they controlled the ball, the worse they did. But like against Mexico, they should have won at Mexico. They had like 43% possession against Mexico. They should have, they destroyed Panama, had like whatever it was, 46% possession against Panama or something. The more they can basically give you the ball and turn you over and use their speed, the better they do. But they don't want to do that. They wanted to do this other thing that they weren't as good at.
That's what I was going to ask. Are they running the right system, right? Should they be playing the Stanford ball and trying to control the ball? Or should they be doing like 2016 Penn State with Joe Moorhead and just like, screw it, Chris Godwin, go deep.
Go deep.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah, I think it really depends. If it's full strength, they might be able to get away with that.
Okay.
What we definitely learned in this was the more aggressive they were, the less they just tried to work the ball around and maybe screw up in the wrong area of the pitch.
Right.
Like the worst they did. It'll be really interesting. And I think most of it just comes down to, like, do you have the right guys there? And so many of the choices Berhalter made as far as personnel or who's starting and all that kind of drove me crazy a little bit. Yeah. But he had one hand tied behind his back the entire tournament, and I acknowledge that.
Do you agree, Ty?
I do.
Okay.
Bill Connolly from ESPN, always the smartest guy in the room, at least this room, for sure this room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We appreciate you stopping by. We have 7.5 months to break this World Cup qualifying drawdown, which I'm sure we'll do with you at some point again here before it gets closer. Bill Connolly, thank you again.
Absolutely.
All right, Dan, there you go. Bill Connolly, ESPN.com. Thank you for helping me get some of those World Cup thoughts out of my system. I appreciate that.
Of course, Ty, come on. I want the dragon to be released. I want you to along with the men's national team, rise like the phoenix out of the disappointment that was 2018.
Yes.
And so I'm always going to be in favor of you bringing that kind of energy to the show.
Absolutely. All right. You wanted to talk Final Four, fast food Final Four. Final Four, to be clear.
By the way, did you watch Duke, North Carolina at all?
I watched the first 3 minutes. I fell asleep, and then I woke up for the final 30 seconds.
Okay. So I've been to a Duke, North Carolina game at Krzyzewskiville, at Cameron Indoor for the old SI gig. I went and covered that scene, the culture of that scene, which is terrific and amazing. And so I have this investment, not in Duke or North Carolina, but I just love the rivalry, as I do most college rivalries. So I had to watch it. And, man, the... not pettiness, but the dagger, you know, the Bill Raftery-isms, the dagger of being Coach K and losing your final regular season game to
North
rival.
Carolina. Oh my gosh.
And then your final tournament in the Final Four game to North Carolina, to Hubert Davis, first year head coach, I believe, right? He just took over for Roy Williams. And I don't know anything about college basketball anymore, but I know enough where, man, the look on Coach K's face. I'm not a Coach K fan. I don't know if you are. I don't know if you like go to his lectures, which, by the way, if you watch a Duke game, you go to his lecture. I've always held a little bit against Coach K, and obviously he's an excellent coach who's done excellent things. He's a legend. But when he lectured Dylan Brooks, the former Oregon player, now NBA player, after Dylan Brooks kind of dunked it at the end of a 14-point
win. Was Dylan Brooks the one with the weird ear?
No, that was Tawan Porter.
Okay, different. I'm showing my college basketball stripes now. Continue.
Dylan Brooks is probably, and he's a good player for the Grizzlies now. So Dylan Brooks is probably the absolute height of former Oregon players who Oregon fans loved and everybody who played Oregon hated. Like, okay. He was a genuine a-hole on the court, but was awesome. It was like a conference player of the year and was Oregon's best player for deep tournament runs. So he was terrific, but he's the one who kind of showed up Duke at the end of a comfortable win. I don't know, Sweet 16, Elite 8, something like that, round of 32 maybe. And Coach K pulled him aside and said, "You're too good to act like that at the end of a game." Okay. Dylan Brooks was like, "Okay, sure, dude." And I just loved that moment so much from Dylan Brooks. So.
I don't have a problem with Coach K. I don't really have a problem with Duke. I don't either way. Like, I'm good.
I've loved Duke players over the years.
I don't have any problem with it. I will admit, when I heard that it was going to be Duke North Carolina, I did fear a little bit for Jim Nance.
Yeah, sure.
That's the kind of situation you figure Duke North Carolina a week removed from the Masters with a probable Tiger comeback.
Yeah.
That's too much.
Is he likely coming back? Is that a thing?
He's coming. He's definitely coming back.
I mean, we are recording this once again, Monday of Masters.
I'll go on the record and say he's coming back. He's coming back.
Okay. And so nothing has been confirmed at the time of this recording. Okay.
No, but he's coming back. And I'll just say that I did worry a little bit for Jim Nance and his ability to sleep and be prepped and ready to go with so much emotional baggage for him to dissect. Let's say, sure, between the Final Four, Coach K, final game, and now the Tiger thing, which I think is going to happen. I did worry a little bit for him. I will say that the North Carolina sending Coach K to his career graveyard is the kind of thing they're going to put in a trophy case somewhere in Chapel Hill.
Unbelievable.
That's the kind of thing that they post on the website. You have to.
Have you know what Duke-related item is in, like, the North Carolina basketball facility, right? So there is, and it's the absolute height of both pettiness and class, which I can appreciate. They have a framed letter from Coach K to Michael Jordan, basically conceding recruiting defeat.
That's right. That's right.
And saying, like, good luck in your career. Like, it's a totally classy, mature letter from Coach K to Michael Jordan. But I believe that is on display in the North Carolina facility. Coach K saying, "Hey, we didn't get you, but good luck with everything." Which obviously went on.
Worked
to be
out okay. Yeah, that
terrific
worked out okay
for all parties involved, I guess, other than Duke. So, yeah, look at us spanning golf,
college
basketball, soccer. We've been talking with guests about boat goals because that was a topic on this show. Jim Nance has to be backyard goals for you, does it not?
Backyard goals?
Do you not know about Jim Nance's backyard?
I know about Jim Nance's toast, and he likes it super burnt. I know he's been on the cover of cigar magazines, which isn't really my cup of tea, but whatever. To each his own. I know he's into golf. I know he's into basketball. I know he's into football. I know a lot about Jim Nance. I don't know about his backyard.
So I'm going to send you a link right now for you to react to live about Jim Nance's backyard. I think in Northern California somewhere. I think not far from Pebble Beach. Take a look at that link and that picture. Jim Nance has a hole, a golf hole, in his backyard. Like, I think you tee off up on a hill.
Look at that.
Yeah. And he, like, brings
celebrities. I'd tell you what, that is a confident man.
It's right next
to his house. Confident man, because if you thin that, it's going through a window.
I want to say Justin Timberlake also had something similar at one point. But would you do that in your own backyard? Maybe not that setup, but that has to be a backyard goal of yours.
I would love to. Oh, yeah. I'd love to.
Yeah.
I don't know how Solid Wife Kate would feel about that.
That's okay. It's a concession. Marriage is about compromise.
Solid Wife Kate is trying to get me to plant a zucchini, and I'm not willing to do that. And so if I come to her with, "Hey, you want to build a golf hole?"
All right, here's what I have for you, by the way, in the final four as we conclude this episode. This, I would say, strong to very strong episode. That's my opinion.
Sure.
The final four is McDonald's fries against the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich, the In-N-Out double-double against the Dairy Queen Blizzard. And the McDonald's fries got there in defeating the Culver's Butterburger. The Chick-fil-A got to the final four defeating Popeye's chicken sandwich. The In-N-Out double-double got there beating the Wendy's Frosty, and the Dairy Queen Blizzard got there beating McMuffins, it just says McMuffins in general.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't have a strong opinion about any of those defeats. I think the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich to me is the spicy one is slightly better than the Popeyes one, but that's a personal preference for the flavor of the Chick-fil-A
spice. But this is the regular Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich.
That's all I can tell. Yes. The right, which is also very good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very good. So I don't have a strong opinion about the double double versus the Dairy Queen Blizzard. I'd be inclined to go double double.
Okay.
Clearly the heavyweights here are McDonald's fries against a Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich. And I just feel like I'll go back to what I said before, either on an off topic show or a Q&A show, or maybe it was one of our college football shows. I don't remember. The McDonald's fries have remained in state for a good long time. And the fact that all of the competition has felt the need to change their recipe or their process or their spices or the level of crispiness, there is definitely a Nick Saban quality to the McDonald's fries in that everybody else has gone nuts trying to match them and they still haven't been able to do it. I love the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich. You know where I stand on that. But
of course,
for me, the alpha, I don't know if you got the sound, the alpha, thank you,
yeah,
is definitely McDonald's fries.
Yeah. Once again, they changed the oil up. And now I think it was like 20 years ago. They went from the essentially rendered beef fat, where they fried the fries in, to, I think, peanut oil. I don't have that information in front of me. My tum-tum can't handle dairy the way it used to. So I just have to sort of be neutral on the Blizzard. I remember it being very good and having different topping mix-ins and all that.
It's fine.
The double-double is good, and I really love In-N-Out. I opt for going two cheeseburgers instead because I think that there's a more balance to the cheeseburger. But that's personal choice. Mention the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich. I would go the chicken sandwich over the fries because if I just channel my inner Marie Kondo, it sparks more joy. If you offered me a carton of McDonald's fries and a Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich, I would be happier to accept the Chick-fil-A chicken
sandwich. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Which do you eat more frequently?
Chick-fil-A.
Right.
Definitely.
And I think that's another reason why you go fries, because I don't get fries that much, but when I get the fries, it's a treat.
Right.
You treat yourself when you get the fries. You know they're not good for you. I mean, none of this stuff's good for you, but the fact that they are unrivaled, the fact mm-hmm. that when I get them, it's a rare treat. The answer is McDonald's fries. They're going all the way.
Are you dipping them in anything? Ketchup? Barbecue?
I mean, I go ketchup. You know, I mean, we've talked about ketchup before. I'll go ketchup. Yeah. Sometimes needs a little salt, depending how they come out. But
wait, the McDonald's fries need additional salt to you?
Sometimes.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, not all the time. But for me, it's fries. Fries are the winner here.
Yeah, I would probably go. I think the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich is a finished masterwork. Okay. Of a product.
Well, look, write in, let us know. And if you want to mix it up with the Verballerhood, you're going out to verballers.com. Again, that's the Patreon. We've had some folks who've been very adamant about this, very adamant about putting this fast food bracket together. I saw the sheet. Somebody put some time in on this, Dan. Like, we got people who are very serious about this, not just serious college football fans, but just serious people, the kinds of people that we wish to associate ourselves with in the Verballerhood. Right. Verballers.com, again, is where you can access that. You can also get access to our shows, our videos, some other odds and ends that aren't available to the general public. Verballers.com. Please subscribe to the show if you haven't already. Follow on social media. SolidGiveaway.com is where you can get access, where you can get your name in the hat. Get access to the hat.
Mm-hmm.
AJ Brown signed Ole Miss mini helmet.
Ooh, hottie toddy. Yeah, I'm looking right now. The In-N-Out Double Double defeated the Arby's Curly Fry.
I'm not a Curly Fry fan. You know that.
Oh, man. I hate curly fries. That's Burrow to Chase
No. I'm staunchly anti-Curly Fry.
Oh, that's insane. They are an insanely good dipper.
They put some sort of spice on those things that you want to talk about upsetting the tum-tum. Yeah, we got to clear the afternoon if we're going curly fries.
That's insane. That's an insane take. I respect that you were courageous enough to make it, but I just fully disagree.
If we're starting this show off by talking about 24-hour bugs and you're talking about your intolerance to dairy.
How can you eat McDonald's fries and say like, no, Arby's fries get you sick?
I don't know what they put on them. They put something on them and I'm telling you, I got to clear the afternoon. I'll eat them, but I know exactly what I'm eating and I know exactly what it's going to do to my tum-tum.
And that's fine. And I'll finish with this. The people who appreciate fast food deep cuts and available menu items know Arby's, while up and down with their sandwiches, right? Some are very strong, some are not as strong. And I have not been to Arby's in quite some time, so I have no idea if this is still true. But people who appreciate a good fast food milkshake know that Arby's has like a Jamocha flavor, like a coffee-ish flavor in there that's not readily available at their competitors. I want to say Jack in the Box might as well. That is when the old Tum Tum could handle dairy in a more positive way. Does Arby's bring it with that? It's very good.
Again, write in solidverbal@gmail.com. Check us out on Patreon. Don't forget to tell folks about the Solid Verbal. Yeah. We will be back later this week. You know what we've been doing each month? We've been talking about teams that correspond to the date. 4-8 teams coming at you on Thursday.
Yeah, buddy.
As we've got April the 8th getting a little bit bigger in the window. For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildebrandt, for our guest of honor, Bill Connolly from ESPN. Thank you so very much for downloading, listening, and supporting the show. We'll be back in a few days. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.